The gravity of this move is not lost on me or our negotiating committee or our board members who have voted unanimously to proceed with a strike. It's a very serious thing that impacts thousands, if not millions, of people all across this country and around the world. Not only members of this union, but people who work in other industries that service the people that work in this industry. And so it came with great sadness that we came to this crossroads, but we had no choice. We are the victims here. We are being victimized by a very greedy entity. I am shocked by the way the people that we have been in business with are treating us. I cannot believe it, quite frankly. How far apart we are on so many things. How they plead poverty, that they're losing money left and right when giving hundreds of millions of dollars to their CEOs. It is disgusting.
That was a clip from Fran Drescher, president of the Screen Actors Guild American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, announcing a historic strike by the union, joining the Writers Guild of America, who have been striking since May. Collective action is the most effective way to bring about social change because it allows people to pool their resources and efforts to achieve a common goal. Strikes are one of the most useful forms of collective action because they can disrupt business operations and pressure employers to make concessions. The purpose of a strike is to grind the money-making machine to a halt and hurt management where it matters, their pocketbook. But as Fran points out in that clip, the strike is intended more as a nuclear deterrent than a go-to tool. Strikes affect jobs and people well outside the industry like a crack slowly expanding on a windshield. They're used only in a worst-case scenario, and believe Fran when she says it's really bad right now. How did things get to this point? And how does sociology fit into this conversation? Today, sociology goes on strike with the help of some Hollywood insiders.
My name's Kurt Scott, or I'm known professionally as KC Scott in the industry. I've been a member of WGA West for about 2.5 years. Prior to that, I worked in labor. We worked together for a number of years at SEIU UHW. And I'm also a strike captain at the Amazon lot here in Culver City. So to the extent that I know about this labor action, it's as both a member and as a person who's responsible for corralling members over at Amazon Studios. But primarily, you know, I'm just a writer who wants his due. So that's my perspective on all of it.
And I'm Courtney Bell. I spent a good 6 years living in LA and a good 15 or so years being an actress. So I used to be in Actors Equity, which is not part of this situation, but I also became a SAG member eventually. I left the industry personally and have become a sociology, like I've got my master's and I'm working towards my PhD right now, but I'm definitely still connected to the industry. My ex, my co-parent with my child, the source of my child support is a writer. He's had good 5 different series on Netflix. And a number of feature-length films. So many of my friends are still SAG members. A close friend of mine was one of the core cast members from the TV series Lost. So, I'm deeply connected still with a number of people who are dealing with this major upheaval in how this industry has existed previously and are very concerned about where it's going.
Yeah, I think you both are bringing really unique perspectives. Kurt, as you mentioned, we both worked at SEIU UHW, which is a union in California that represents healthcare workers. So you've been part of strikes in another industry. And then Courtney, as you mentioned, you're a sociologist now and you view strikes from a different perspective. So I just wanted to give that kind of context there. So when we chatted previously, it was clear that people like me who aren't familiar with the industry don't understand certain problems, such as the behind-the-scenes mechanics of content distribution. Can you both quickly go over the demands behind the respective strikes?
Sure. I'll give an overview that's kind of nested in my narrow perspective. I'm obviously not a member of the negotiating committee, and I don't speak for the guild, just myself. But I think the pain points for me as a writer and for a lot of my writer friends are around mini rooms. That's a big one. You know, back in the day when broadcast was king, you could expect to work on a show for a good 20 to 26 to 32 weeks out of the year. Once streaming started to dominate, that was condensed to 20 weeks. And in fact, my first job was 20 weeks. And, you know, some sacrifice there. And then what we've seen over the last 5 years or so is the rise of the mini room, which often looks like collecting a number of writers for a very brief period of time, say 3 to 6 weeks. I've heard of 1 week mini rooms. You'll have the blue sky, which is just generate ideas for the series. And then those ideas are then taken and turned into episodes by a much smaller collection of writers, or maybe even one writer, the creator slash showrunner. You know, I've been in one mini room where I did get to write an episode, but it was essentially as a freelance writer once the room concluded. So the way that it should work is that you get your weekly fee or your episodic fee, depending on what level you're at as a writer. You know, producers and above typically are paid by episode. You know, writers who are lower down on the scale are paid by week. And on top of that, you get your episodic fee. And as you're writing your episode, you are receiving both your weekly fee and eventually your episode fee in steps, you know, for the treatment, for the outline, for the episode itself. But what happens with these mini rooms is, you know, you're either not getting an episode at all. You've, you know, given away your ideas essentially for, let's say, 3 weeks of pay. Or you do get an episode, but that episode is essentially written on your own time. The room concludes and you are writing that episode without drawing an episodic fee. And writing an episode is no joke. You know, it can take weeks. There are rewrites. I've seen it take months. And, you know, the episodic fee does not go that far if you're devoting all of that time. So that's one of the key issues. Another one of the key issues is AI. I think that's for the lack of a better way to put it, one of the sexier things that we've been talking about. So just because there isn't an industry in labor across the world that isn't or won't be touched by AI, at least potentially. But from a writer's perspective, what we were seeking as a guild going into these negotiations is an assurance that our work would not be replaced by artificial intelligence, which honestly, if you're describing it accurately, is actually plagiarism software, right? Like machines do not have, you know, intelligence. What they do have the capacity to do is comb 30,000 scripts that have been written by real life human writers since scripts were a thing, and then condense them and draw impressions and sometimes draw entire excerpts and basically congeal them into a new piece of work that steals from working writers. And so we can't have that. I mean, obviously, if that becomes prevalent, that's the death of our profession. We were looking for insurance that studios didn't want to see the death of our profession. And we had very specific language around that. And what they came back and said is, hey, why don't we meet and confer periodically about where we are, the state of AI, the state of business, and trust us, we'll be fine. Obviously, that was unacceptable to us. And so we didn't move forward there. Another issue that's important to us is streaming residuals. Again, back when broadcast shows were kind of the gold standard, can expect to, you know, make up a significant portion of your income drawing residuals from the shows that you worked on based on their popularity. You know, how many times they air, how many people watched them. It was a way for you to participate in the success of the show that you worked on. What's since happened is the model around TV has been updated, but streaming residuals calculation has not been updated to match it. So these big streamers, you know, your Netflixes, your Hulus, your Disneys, they're notoriously unwilling to share their data. I've been in conversations with creators who, when they go to talk with execs about how their show is doing, they get adjectives. They don't get data. They don't get numbers. Oh, it's doing really well. oh, we're beating expectations. Oh, no, like, you know, it's on the front page because, you know, we want eyeballs on it. Okay, but tell me how it's doing in terms of numbers. They don't want to share that because it's proprietary. And so what that's led to is we don't know how well we're doing, and our streaming residuals are not tied to the success of the show. So we're not getting a piece of the success of these massive, massive series. You know, like I think I read an interview from the Squid Game creator who really got, like, you know, the upfront payment, which is what Netflix in particular is famous for. They essentially give you the money, like, right up front, and that's it. We are buying your intellectual property. I don't care if it becomes the biggest show that our streamer has seen in 5 years. You will not see another dime besides, you know, what we're offering you on the front end. We want back end, you know, we want to participate in the success of these massive shows. And up to this point, the streamers have not been willing. And there are other issues, you know, it'd be very difficult without looking at the proposal sheet to just go down them. But room size is another one. We don't want to see a lot of shows that are based around, you know, like a single showrunner, right, who's expected to write and break, you know, 10 episodes in a season. Not because we don't want creators to feel like they have an auteuristic vision, but because that's typically not how good television is made, right? Like, people like to hold up the Mike White example, The White Lotus, which, you know, brilliant show, loved it. But for every Mike White, there are, you know, 500 successful series that needed a writer's room. And who's to say that The White Lotus couldn't have been better with a writer's room? And I mean, argue that it could. Like, no show's perfect, and seven minds is typically better than one. And so we are arguing that there should be a minimum number of staff writers who get jobs in these rooms. And then finally, as far as the ones that occurred to me as the big ones, set experience. We as writers want to be paid to produce our own episodes. Like, one, as the person who wrote the episode, I might have something valuable to say about, you know, the artistic vision that plays out on set. And two, as someone who would like to run his own show someday, if I'm not going to set, I'm not going to have the tools to create and run my own show. And so, you know, that one I find particularly confusing because the studios are essentially cutting off their own noses to spite their faces. If people like me, mid-level writers, aren't going to set and learning how to produce, 5-10 years down the road, you're just going to see a real dearth of folks who can do the job. And I don't see how they make money if that's the case. And certainly my profession and my livelihood is hurt if I don't have those tools. So, you know, those are the basic things that we're fighting for. I mean, I think you can categorize all of them under the dignity of profession and fair compensation for all the value that we bring to these multi-billion dollar companies. And yeah, we're willing to just walk and fight as long as it takes to get what we need.
As someone who really enjoyed the Hulu show Reboot, you just crushed what I understand. Oh, really? About writers' rooms. Just like, because, <Yeah. one> you know, in that show, you have the really small writers' room, and then you know, the head writer sitting on set giving directions to the actors. And
well, you do see that, like, still fairly often. Like, the showrunner is typically going to be on set, you know, executing their vision. But what really needs to happen is the showrunner and the writer from her staff who actually wrote the episode needs to be there as well, right? My boss, you know, the showrunner, is going to have a pretty good grasp on the content. Is she going to have as good of a grasp, or is she going to be able to share my perspective as someone who is actually wrestling with the words for several weeks? And, you know, no. Those two things are additive and both need to be there. I think in that sense, Reboot is probably pretty accurate from the standpoint that I actually don't remember the writers from the writer's room being on set. So kudos to them for an accurate reflection of the state of the industry.
True. I can't recall that happening either. Courtney, I'm sure there's a lot of overlap here. Yeah. In terms of what the actors are asking for.
Yeah, for sure. Just to note, just a couple of points of comparison, that WGA is a union of 30,000 members. SAG-AFTRA is 160,000 members. And so WGA, their previous contracts were up and those negotiations were not met starting, was it May?
May 1st was the first day of the strike.
Thank you. Yep. And then, yeah, the SAG just started their strike because their contract had been set to expire at a different time. And then they just, within the last couple of weeks, have stopped working. And that's a huge boon to the writers, because when you have close to 200,000 voices, that puts more pressure on the AMPTP, which is the sort of top movie producers. That's who generally people are thinking of as the bad guy against everybody. So if I may, I kind of want to just to give the complete non-industry knowledge having person a sense of like how the industry used to work versus what's happening in it now. I feel like people don't necessarily know where money comes from, who has it, and where it goes. So to sort of back up a little bit. So the three of us, I think we're all like Gen X age people. Kurt, you got a little salt in your beard. So I'm assuming we all remember the 90s. Kurt used the expression broadcast was king. And so we remember Thursday night primetime. You're going to watch Seinfeld and then Friends. And then like late in the 90s was when Will and Grace was on. And like that was the hot night of TV. The way the networks used to measure their own success was how much money can we charge advertisers to show commercials during the show? And we remember the theme song would come on and then there'd be 2 minutes of commercials. And then at the 15-minute mark, every 15 minutes, whether it was a 30-minute or a 60-minute show, every 15 minutes, you're going to have to be stuck watching commercials. So if you're Coca-Cola and you want lots and lots of people to see your commercial, you are going to pay NBC lots of money so that you can show your Coca-Cola ad during Friends on Thursday night, right? That's a hot spot. And NBC can take millions of dollars from their ads and that money. So it, let's say they get $10 million from Coca-Cola to show that ad at that time. Then they say, okay, now we have $10 million. We can pay ourselves. We're going to pay the core cast of the Friends, the actors, the producers, the, you know, all, everybody's getting paid from the Coca-Cola money and the Honda money and the, you know, what, whoever the products are. So then we kind of hit the early aughts and this stuff called DVR comes around where you can just record the show and then fast forward through the commercials. And then we get Netflix, which starts out as a DVD mailing service, but then very quickly, right around 2010 is when things kind of start shifting even more to like the high speed online stuff. So the last writer's strike that happened in 2007, as these networks were starting to learn, like, hey, we can show our stuff online. The last writer's strike, so the number one show at that time, one of them was The Office. And The Office was showing, like, they would say, hey, go to, I think, NBC or ABC online, and you can watch extra scenes that are not in the show. And because online was experimental media, those networks were able to say, hey, we don't have to pay the writers for these extra scenes that they're putting up online. We can film them and we can still charge because there were still advertisements in the online viewing stuff that they were bringing in money and not sharing it, right? And so that's what all of these strikes have kind of been about, is that there is money coming in and fewer people are seeing any piece of it. So now that Netflix streaming has become an Amazon Prime and, you know, but like, think about the last time you were like, oh, I have to watch a show at a time. No one does that anymore. You turn on Hulu, you turn on Netflix, you turn on Apple TV, all of these things, you watch it when you want to watch it. And most of us, if any of them have advertisements, we skip them. And so the entire structure of how the networks made their money and distribute it has been upended, right? The other thing that has gone down a lot is that, and in particular for actors, and I'm assuming also for writers and for directors, is that no one buys physical media anymore. When is the last time you bought a DVD or a Blu-ray or a VHS, right? So it used to be that if you made a movie, you would get paid for making it, and then residuals would come. So NBC produced Friends. They paid Friends. They get a contract to air Friends for a certain amount of time. And because it's a popular show, they can charge money for ads for a long time. Then they sell it to Nick at Night, right? And then you can watch reruns of Friends on Nick at Night, and Nick at Night pays NBC. And they say, okay, we'll give you $100,000 so that we can show Friends for 6 months. And then that contract runs out and then they stop showing it. So that's where the money has been kind of flowing. And then when we have streaming where it's like, now Netflix is generating original content, and as is Amazon Prime, as are all of the services, that because it's functioning without the sales of the physical media and without any advertising revenue, it's all based on subscriptions, right? And so what Kurt was saying before is that most people who are involved are paid in a lump sum at the beginning. And so what Netflix started to do, and their Netflix is the one that has kind of like upended things the most. But, you know, they'll sort of say, okay, we'll give you, whereas it might have been, we'll give you 10 grand an episode for your work on this show. And then every time we sell it to Nick at Night or to other streaming services, you'll get a check in the mail for that too, forever, or for 10 years, or however long the contract is negotiated for. Netflix has been saying, okay, we'll give you $1 million, but we have this forever. And so you get this bigger cut up front, and then it turns out you over time are really losing money. So these cultural moments where it's like, oh my God, the new season of Stranger Things, or Orange is the New Black, or, you know, so many of these things, it's like all of those people get paid once and Netflix can just keep showing it forever. And at a certain point, Netflix is still able to make money because we're all still paying our $19.99 a month, and they don't have to give it to those who worked to create it.
I have a quick question, though, because I've noticed in the media, one thing that's been happening is that streaming services have been pulling shows off their services in order to not pay residuals. So one of them was Disney Plus pulling shows like Willow and the Mysterious Benedict Society. They were produced for that streaming service and now are no longer available, which means I'm sure that the actors, the creators, the writers, because they're not released on physical media, they're essentially gone, right? Unless they get sold to another streaming service. But how does that work if they... are some of the streaming services paying residuals? Is it like Netflix is the one that isn't, but Disney Plus is?
What I've observed from a writer's standpoint is they're working toward two benefits. One is not having to pay residuals to writers and actors, but also it's the tax write-off. And I think, if you want to call it an innovation, HBO or Max, as it's called now, David Zaslav, the CEO of Warner Discovery, he kind of innovated that. Just realize that if you need to make your quarter, you can just take the show off your service, chalk it up to a loss, and rebalance your books on that basis. So now you've seen a number of other, like you're seeing Disney do the same thing. And it's a shame because now it was just kind of a handshake understanding, if you're a creator, that if you created a show for one of these streamers, your show would exist essentially in perpetuity. And you're cool with that, especially since there will never be physical media released for whatever you create. And now without physical media and the trend of these streamers pulling these series off or this content off or tax write-offs, I mean, you could see your baby, you know, this thing that you poured sweat equity in just disappear into the ether, and you have nothing to show for all of your hard work.
And really the audiences lose that too, because, you know, I personally liked some of those shows and now we can't watch them anymore. Mm-hmm. The movie Batgirl, which was famously pulled from HBO, it was done. Yeah. The movie was done and they just scrapped it and said, no one will ever watch this. Mm-hmm. And people wanted to see it. I want to get into something that you mentioned, Courtney. So the last time both unions went on strike simultaneously was in 1959 when Ronald Reagan was brought in for negotiations. There's a joke there somewhere. I don't know it off the top of my head, but oh, you got to do
it. I was going to say he's a real man of the people before he was president.
Unless you work for the air traffic controllers. So there have been more recent strikes by both unions. You mentioned the WGA strike in 2007. And I think the most notable but not recent SAG strike lasted for 3 months in 1980 and was over issues related to home video residuals. What are the historical precedents and lessons learned from these strikes and their impacts on the industry? Because when I hear both of you describe how things are going, it seems like things have, I know it's a technological change, but things are pretty terrible. And it seems like fighting the same battles over and over again.
I mean, essentially, that's exactly what it is.
Okay. I answered the question.
So when new technology develops, then it's like, this is a thing that didn't exist before. And no one, do you get money from that? Do I get money from that? I don't know. You don't know. Well, let's try and figure it out. And usually there's a little bit of a grace period where they go, no one knows what this is. So we'll just take all the money, but don't worry, we'll give you a fair share. And that tends to come from the executives. And the working people, the creative parts of it say, okay, well, yeah, we're with you. And then after, whether it's months or a year or so, they go, hey, you're actually making lots of money, but you're not giving us any. And just so we're clear, there are 9, 10. I wrote them all down. So there's a list that's been circulating. Kurt, you may have seen this one. The one, it's like the top 10 executives that are members of AMPTP organizations. So this is like David Zaslav, who is the CEO of Warner Brothers Discovery. This is a man whose annual salary is $39.3 million a year. That's up from previous years. And again, like for the purposes of anyone listening, I got out my calculator. That means that this is a man who makes $3.2 million a month or $755,000 every week or $107,671 a day. And he is not willing to share in his province with the artists who are helping to make him that rich. So he's the top paid. The lowest paid, which is on this list of the top 10, is Patrick Whitesell from Endeavor. He only makes a pittance of $12.2 million a year. That washes out to only $33,000 a day, the poor man. And how is he expected to make ends meet after living above the annual poverty income every day? Like every day, $33,000 a day. I would do fine on that. I'd be okay. And the thing is that one of the things that I sort of see viscerally is that so many people who are not affiliated with the industry will look at these strikes and they'll be like, oh, well, there's Fran Drescher and there's Mark Ruffalo and they're millionaires and they're being like, pay us more money. And it's like, well, Mark Ruffalo, I'm sure, has a healthy net worth, but he's lending his voice to help all the other people who don't. And he's smart. He knows if I tweet something, people are going to see it. So I'm going to help. And he certainly is not making the equivalent to what Zaslav or Bob Iger from Disney or Ted Sarandos from Netflix is making. And so just so that everyone is clear, it's very similar to, I remember when the baseball players went on strike and it's like, people would be like, well, they're making $10 million a year and now they want 20. Ugh. And it's like, well, but you see, we all buy tickets to baseball games and the managers and the owners are making billions and we would just like a piece. And so I see it as this is connected to the historical strikes in that as innovations get made with how quickly and how, you know, what technology allows us to do in terms of creation, production, and dissemination, there becomes less and less need for masses of people to make it. And that is great for efficiency and terrible for masses of people.
And Kurt, we've definitely heard this argument before with the nonprofit hospital executives making millions while we were out there on picket lines with healthcare workers who made minimum wage or like a little bit above minimum wage. And the argument is always that even with nonprofits, that they need to offer that salary to get the talent to run the organization or the company or whatever. So this all sounds so familiar to me, at least.
It does sound really familiar. I remember, so I worked in research for SEIU-HW, and the study that my mind keeps going back to is the one that determined that there's a threshold above which a high salary stops being correlated to talent with CEOs. And I believe that threshold is $325,000. You pay the CEO over $325,000 and there's no more value add. You are not attracting more talent with a higher salary. I mean, at that point, it just simply becomes cultural. And coming from the hospital industry in California, which is easily, as far as the executives are concerned, the C-suite's concerned, the highest paid in all of the United States, I was not prepared for how American media is magnitudes more disgusting in terms of inflation of CEO pay. I mean, that someone like David Zaslav could make over $200, approaching $300 million a year, you know, including stock options, just blows my mind, you know, and part of it is just, like I said, cultural expectation that media executives make a ton of money. Why? Well, like once you start parsing like the value that you bring, it becomes a lot harder to justify. But I think the fact of the matter is, like in any industry, including ours, is that there's a lot of class solidarity happening. You know, David Zaslav is not drawing the salary that he does simply because he's bullied his way to the top. He's drawing the salary that he does because he has a lot of allies on the board who want to secure their positions, who want to secure their relationships in the industry, and they see their meal ticket, you know, the long-term prosperity as David Zaslav. I think another part of it is, and this didn't really click for me until recently, like how is it that you have this industry where these massive streamers, these massive studios are making money hand over fist, but they keep squeezing us at the bottom. Like your Fran Drescher, your Chris Pine, you know, your Tom Cruise, oftentimes like we've been talking about, like observers from the outside like to assert that they like somehow exemplify rank and file actors. And that's not true at all. Like I think I read that the average SAG member makes less than $65,000. The average WJ member certainly makes a hell of a lot less than Shonda Rhimes, you know what I mean? And so to prop that less than 0.01% of earners up and say, well, what are they complaining about, completely misrepresents the truth. But I think at the end of the day, why, you know, what David Zaslav manages to maintain his pay and maintain his position is that he's bringing the board a promise. And I think that promise right now at this moment in history is I'm going to evolve the industry to the point where we don't need to pay writers and actors, where we don't need writers and actors at all. And so for them, even though they're taking it on the nose right now, you know, losing billions of dollars since the beginning of the WGA strike, all the productions have now been shut down since the beginning of the SAG strike. You know, the PR hits that they're taking couldn't be worse. But that one lottery ticket for investors, for the board, you know, that one possibility that that a David Zaslav could execute a vision where they don't need to pay any working people to put out content is for them worth dealing with the pain for however long. I don't know whether that's another 2 months. I don't know whether that's another 6 months. I don't know if that's another year, frankly. You know, we're willing to see it to the end. But the thing that just disturbs me so much is that when people say that this is an existential fight, it absolutely is. I truly feel like there are members of the AMPTP that are out for annihilation.
And they've said as much. I mean, most of the executives go away for the summer. So like they said, fine, let them strike. We're all going on vacation. We won't be back to the table to negotiate. And they have said, we feel comfortable waiting till the summer. We'll starve them out until they start losing their houses. Like probably in September is when people will start losing their houses. And so we're good to go for that long. And the thing with SAG, even more so than writers, is that the bulk of SAG members are actors who all have a day job. They or a some second source of revenue. So they're like, you think you're gonna starve us out? I'm working at Starbucks, you know, 40 hours a week and working, you know, when I book stuff too. So like, I'm good to go till October. Don't worry, we'll be fine. And so, yeah, my understanding is that there is a huge sort of impasse that everyone's kind of expecting to hit in the fall. like the AMPTP isn't expecting it to go past fall, but the SAG might be able to. And so at this point, there were already a number of productions that were sort of in the can, if you will, that was already done. And that, you know, like, for example, Oppenheimer and Barbie, like they were already shot. They were not affected by these strikes. They're going to start running out of content, out of new stuff in the spring. And normally in Hollywood, a lot of stuff kicks into production in the fall. That's you get your fall TV lineup, which still, even if we're not necessarily watching it on a schedule, that, it, you know, the fall is generally when a lot of things kick in. And then Hollywood is also notorious for, just in years past, basically between whenever Thanksgiving happens and the end of January, the town is just dead because people go away for Thanksgiving, then they go away for Christmas or Hanukkah, and then they all go to Sundance. And the Sundance Film Festival is the end of January. And so no one is closing deals or starting productions between the end of November, late January. And so if they haven't figured it out by November, then they're not going to figure it out until February. And then it's really going to start hurting the AMPTP a little more than I think they're ready for.
So obviously, being a sociology podcast, we want to look a little at the sociological aspect behind the strike. And Kurt, can you talk a little about how the strike impacts the livelihoods and well-being of striking workers and their families? What's it like being a striking worker, and how does that impact you?
Yeah, I mean, listen, the uncertainty is stressful. I will credit Guild leadership for the fact that they've been preparing us for this moment for over a year. I've been hearing nothing but on May 2023, we're going to go on strike because that's when the rubber's going to meet the road. And so I've had the good fortune of working a lot over these last couple of years, and I've been saving with this moment in mind. And so I'm fortunate from the standpoint that I don't have to worry about losing my housing. I have two kids, ages 7 and 5. I don't have to worry, you know, that I'm not going to be able to afford preschool tuition because we prepared and, you know, my family's been lucky and I'm really grateful for that. However, I don't know what 2 years looks like from now. You know, I'm definitely dipping into savings, and those are savings that I had plans for my kids specifically. And so it feels deeply unfair that I need to be coming out of pocket and depriving my kids of opportunity down the road because the streamers have a strategy of trying to starve us out. You know, I was talking with a friend on the line. His name's John Sherman. He wrote for the original Frasier and has done a bunch of things since, but he had a really observation about, I guess, what I would consider the studio's miscalculation around those quotes that came out a couple of weeks ago. I can't remember which trade it was in, Deadline or Variety, but you know, it was what Courtney was alluding to, which is that they essentially said, listen, we'll come back to the table once the writers have felt some pain. We're going to wait for them to lose their homes. You know, we're going to wait for them to default on their mortgages. And then when they're really, really hurting, then we'll negotiate on those terms. What he said, I found really interesting, which is that when you eliminate the middle class, which is really what the streaming model has done in our industry, you know, what you essentially have at the end of the day are the people who can afford to wait it out or the people who have absolutely nothing to lose. They weren't working beforehand. They had to make other provisions with a day job, with gig work, moving in with their parents, maybe going out and finding a fourth roommate, you know, whatever they had to do to make ends. Like, that's been their reality for years. So when you tell me that the next few months are going to introduce a unique pain to my life, that tells me you do not understand what my life has been over this period of time. And so I genuinely feel that the industry has been caught off guard, you know, by that to some degree, like just by the sheer desperation that's out there. You know, like I've had some of the funniest signs that I've seen since those quotes come out have been something to the effect of, you think you're going to make me broke? I mean, the joke's on you. I was already broke. And so when you've got a bunch of broke people who are collected talking about how broke they are. And, you know, we're talking about people who are working on hit shows like The Bear. It was this really compelling piece that came out written by a staff writer on The Bear who was on food stamps because, you know, he just was paid on a short contract order, you know, at the minimum. And that's what happens. You can't make it in a city like New York or Los Angeles when you're making that little. those, when you get a bunch of us together and we start comparing experiences, we get angry and we get more resolved. And then when you compound it by doing really awful, evil things like trimming the trees at the universal lot to deny us shade, what do you think is going to happen? But, and I'll borrow the quote from Fran, which I thought was perfect last Thursday. Like, people are going to storm the gates of Versailles. Like, that's what's going to happen. There is nothing to do but that. So as worried as I am about whether I'm going to have a viable career in a couple of years or, you know, even in a few months, or, you know, whether there's going to be a place for writers, whether there's going to be a place for actors, it helps being in the boat with a whole lot of people. And it helps knowing that we're dealing with a party that can't be trusted, and there was no other option but the one we're pursuing right now, which is to just meet this fight and throw everything we've got at it. Because it's like Courtney laid out previous strikes. I think the premise that the other side always brings to the table is, hey, you know, we're entering, you know, new territory. Nobody knows what this technology is. Cope with, like, deal with us as we all figure it out and we'll all get paid. I think SAG, I think WGA is just way too sophisticated for that right now. And I think a lot of the rank and file membership is way too desperate at this point for these handshake agreements. We want you to tell us in brass tacks and black and white how you're going to make sure that our livelihoods aren't eliminated in the very near future. And since they haven't been able to do that, we're going to keep trying to kick their ass. We're going to win, and we are going to win eventually.
To your question, Matthew, about from a sociological standpoint, like, why is this? Are we just celebrity obsessed people talking about Hollywood? No, like, this is very much the wealthiest 1% or 0.5% versus, you know, there's a lot of marks in this. But one of the things that I wanted to bring up was that the last big strike in 06, 07, the writer's strike, that cost the state of California something like $2 billion in losses. And it's not just actors, writers, directors who are affected by it. It's that there are catering companies, there are dry cleaners, there are driving services. Like, there's so many other industries that make their entire livelihood supporting the film industry. And a lot of people went out of business. There are people who had to move back to wherever they went, you know, and it's not just people who it's like, I'm trying to be an actor, I'm trying to be a writer. It's people who are like, you know, I have a food truck and my whole job is I get to drive to whatever lot and I serve craft services to the people at Grey's Anatomy, who then get put out of business by the fact that productions have stopped at this point. I think to one of the things that Kurt was saying is that, you know, you have people who are saying, I'm not going to take this anymore. And the more desperate people get, the stronger they become when they maintain their numbers. I also feel like we're at this point with AI where the stakes feel like they've never really been higher, because it's not just that, like, oh, now they're making VHS tapes of this thing that I made and I want some of those sales, and oh, they also started DVDs, and it's like a slightly different sense of the same thing. But now what they're able to do by generating an actor's likeness is terrifying. And in terms, like, we've all, a lot of people have heard about ChatGPT. That was like the big thing that's kind of happened at the, you know, late spring, early summer. Academia is worried about it. It's just plagiarism sort of happening. And there was this story that has been sort of refuted. So I, you know, I'm not a journalist at a reputable, but like, there were refuted reportings. And I'm only sharing this because if this is a thing that didn't happen, it didn't happen yet, and it is certainly able to happen. But there was this reporting that came out that Bruce Willis had sold his likeness in perpetuity. He has, I can't remember, aphasia. I think he has a brain disorder, and he's sort of retired from acting. And so it was reported and then unreported that he licensed the use of his image to beyond his death, which, again, I believe that that is actually not true, but like, we're within 5 years of people being able to do that. And so theoretically, if you consider that, you could have a David Zaslav, just one dude, and he could say, okay, ChatGPT, write me Die Hard 10, 12, 26, 249, starring Bruce Willis, and we could just be watching, you know, Die Hard 38,492 for the rest of forever, and no one else needs to get paid. There's a big to-do with background actors, and a SAG background actor typically, I think the going rate is like $187 a day, and they buy your day. So it's like, they say 187 for eight is usually what they'll say, and that means for 8 hours. And then if you go over 8 hours, then they add more to it. And then you get into like golden time, where if you're over 12 hours or 14 hours, then you get paid double and things like that. But yeah, I mean, if you're doing a show, you know, years ago, I was background on John Adams with Paul Giamatti, an HBO series. And I did about 2 weeks of background. And it wasn't just 2 weeks of shooting. It was also like I had to come in and get measured for my petticoats. And because we were all wearing the period costuming, and we had to come in and do a makeup test where they like painted our teeth brown and stuff. And, you know, there were probably 500 extras back then. And even then, in big crowd scenes, they would do what was called paneling. So they would say, all right, all of you 500 people, you stand this way on the left-hand side of this building, and you all shout huzzah, and we'll scan that. And then what we're going to do is we're going to have you same 500 people all move over to the right side of that building, and we'll mix you up and have the front people standing in the back. We're now in the front, and da-da-da. And so it's like just a big crowd. And we can do what's called paneling. And through the magic of AI from 15, 20 years ago, we can make it look like there's 1,000 people when we only had 500. What they're offering now is, hey, for $300 and 2 hours of work, will you come in and let us scan your face? And then we can just use it for stuff. And they don't have any rules as to for how long or which projects. And so if you're someone who, and you know, there are people who make their whole careers doing background work, it's not the worst way to make a living, because you can sit and like, you know, knit scarves or whatever that you sell on Etsy. You know, people do that, and they have whatever side hustle they have that they do with doing background work. They're basically making it so that if we can scan people's faces, then we don't need all these people. And so then we don't have to pay the background workers, but then you also don't have to pay as many costumers or as many makeup artists or as many just PAs and set wranglers and all of this stuff. So everything has such a trickle down impact. Like the ripple effects are wide for all of these, you know, proposed things. And we don't know how far AI is gonna go, you know, at some point robots will rise up.
I'm glad both of you have brought up that point that AI is going to affect many industries, not just the entertainment industry. But okay, I'm going to be positive here. I'm going to say, because there are going to be people who are listening to this episode and the strikes are over, and let's just say like everything went really well. So I'm going to be totally positive. Do you think that there will be the potential ripple effects on related industries and sectors, like the ones that you're describing? Because one thing that's occurred over the last, I don't know how many years, is that unionization rates are actually increasing. And we're seeing sectors that are unionizing that were historically were not unionized. So what I want to say is that one thing that keeps coming up in the industry is this burden of never-ending. Disney, Marvel Productions have placed visual effects artists who are not unionized. They've overworked the visual effects artists. And AI obviously has become a hot topic in that area too, as you were just describing. There was a lot of criticism when Marvel used AI to compose the opening credits of its new show, Secret Invasion. I don't know if either of you have watched that, but the opening credits are all AI generated, which typically a visual effects artist would do that. So I imagine it's putting a lot of industry workers at risk. Do you think that they're next, that we're going to see more people who are in the industry, not just in the industry, but like outside the industry, unionizing and going after this technological change?
I think so. I actually was just hearing a story on NPR about the legal profession and how basically what AI can do instantaneously is the work of a full-time paralegal, which is like, oh, you have to research this briefing or that briefing and find all of this information. And that, you know, by putting in just a couple of keywords, that AI is able to produce stuff that is the work of paralegals. And so there's another industry where it can make us more efficient, and that's good for the client that the thing gets done. And it's great that like movies can get made faster and they come and they're just on my TV. I don't have to put on pants to watch it. I can just, you know, watch 10 hours and waste my life. It's wonderful. And yet, like, because AI is going to have such a big impact in so many industries, I don't know how we can't, like, at some point be like, stop, there must be a stop to this.
Yeah. Kurt, I loved your description of it as basically a plagiarism machine, because both Courtney and I have taught undergraduate classes, and the ChatGPT of, you know, essays and papers is occurring. And the thing is, like, right now, it's not great. It creates false information. Courtney, to your point about the paralegals, there was a case that was thrown out because the lawyer cited a legal precedent that didn't exist because ChatGPT or whatever they used made it up. So this is the perfect time to strike, right? Because it's still not perfect, but it's going to get there, right? I don't know, Kurt, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like when, you know, the engineers who are actively working on, you know, developing these AI tools come out and say that it's an extinction level event that we're barreling towards, I'm inclined to believe them. I mean, that's what it feels like. I literally cannot think of a single profession or art form that's insulated from the effects of AI. Maybe today they are, but 5 years, 10 years from now, absolutely not. I mean, I'd love to see more government regulation around it. I think ultimately there's going to have to be a governmental solution. I think there is going to have to be coordination between nations around AI. I have a neighbor down the street who, as I was walking into the house one day, he began to explain to me that, you know, like, you should really be afraid of AI. I myself am a musician who plays in small punk venues, so I'm always going to have an audience who wants to see a live human. And it's just like, I had to tell him, you know, the arrogance of that, for you to believe that live performance, I don't care how weird it is or how off-kilter it is, that live performance is going to be insulated from the effects of AI, as though, you know, we haven't been seeing holograms for 10 years. You know, I remember Tupac and the Michael Jackson performances at Coachella. Like, that is so deluded. And so I think people are starting to wake up to that. And I think that it's happening in a labor context, which is really, really helpful. One of the frustrations that I had as a labor professional working in research over the years, and Matt, I'm sure you've heard the same, is the labor haters, you know, the folks who don't work, you know, in unionized workforces, who shout down unions and, you know, like, who needs them, like, aside from low-skilled labor, et cetera, I'm fine without it because I have marketable skills. What I've come to realize about a lot of people like that is they want to see their own sense of powerlessness reflected in the world around them. Like, that's an easier way to sleep at night if you imagine that everyone can or at least should be as powerless as you are. I think what a lot of people are waking up to, that, you know, like this summer in particular, is that they really aren't that powerless. You know, like the Teamsters are going on strike at UPS. Because they decided that it's unacceptable that part-time workers make $16 an hour, and it absolutely is. So you can see 350,000 drivers walking. IATSE is threatening to strike Broadway productions, you know, shutting down Broadway and touring companies too.
IATSE, the union of like the tech people, like production hands.
That's right. Yeah. The International Alliance of Stage Theater, something otherwise. But yes. You know, the techs and support staff and, you know, essentially the people who make
lighting people, sound people,
exactly.
People who make both the film and theater, for the non-industry related listener to the pod.
What did the smartless guy say? Like Marion, Wisconsin?
Tracy from Wisconsin.
Tracy from Wisconsin. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, great. I'm obsessed with the smartless podcast. By the way, so this comes back around. So Jason Bateman, for example, who hosts the Smartless podcast.
Yeah.
Tracy from Wisconsin knows that. But so he's what is referred to in the industry as a hyphenate. So like one of the things that's really interesting about this strike is the DGA went ahead and sort of caved. Like they negotiated with the AMPTP. There was a lot of pressure from outside, like the writer's strike were like, hey, why don't you promise not to work with AI? And so, you know, again, my ex also is a hyphenate. So he belongs to DGA and WGA. Jason Bateman, who has directed many episodes of Ozark, is also a SAG actor. So if he loses money as a director, he can still make money as an actor. If my ex loses money as a director, he still makes money as a writer. But the DGA is a union that has a lot of powerful members who are not hyphenates. And so they don't want to lose, they, you know, they don't want to lose their opportunities to create more and more stuff, even if AI hurts those around them. And so when you have like any creative industry has thousands of people clamoring to get it. And so if you say, well, I'm not going to take that crap deal, there will always be someone who will take that deal. That's just the nature of it works that way in music. It works that way in modeling. It works that way in, you know, anything that is a job that people love doing, essentially. And so just to sort of bring it all back to where the power structure is that, you know, a lot of people have, or I've had conversations with people who have said, well, what about the directors and what are they doing? And it's like, well, there's apparently a growing faction within the DGA of those who are hyphenates in there or are just more empathic to the writers and the screen actors. And the other thing that is important to know is that the DGA also is, they still get paid for like news content and something else.
Sports and so forth. Yeah.
It's for sports. Yeah. They get to negotiate for sports too. So if they had not negotiated with the AMPTP, that would have crushed the AMPTP. They would have said, oh my God, we're not going to have anything anywhere. But the fact that the DGA kind of decided to work with them was a blow. And it's kind of been since the Screen Actors Guild has joined in, has been a huge boon.
But so DGA, I don't know if we said this before, as directors.
Oh, wow. Was I defining right? Hyphenates without talking about the DGA? Yeah.
They could have ended it, essentially. Like, if they had gone on strike, they could have ended it, right?
I mean, a lot of people sort of would suggest that. Or certainly this would have been a much faster... They would have raced to the negotiating table if they had had that as a looming threat.
All right, well, and does anyone have anything they want to add? I don't want to take up too much more time.
All I would say is... If I've sounded negative, I mean, what I would want to leave people with is I do feel like we're going to win, like unless you want to see this industry crumble. And for a lot of us, it already has. The studios can afford to lose, so to speak, on, you know, the negotiating terms. We can't. And that's ultimately what it comes down to. We can't afford the status quo, let alone, you know, to continue to lose ground on issues like AI, shrinking writers' rooms, you know, self-tapes where the actors are concerned. Like, it's just, they've made the conditions hard enough that this was the only path forward, and we're taking it. And like I said, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know when this is all going to end, but I do expect a positive outcome. And I feel emboldened right now. I think we're in, like, I've seen the hashtag hot labor summer. I think we're in a hot labor summer, you know, both in the industry and outside of it. And I'm really excited about the things to come.
I think that there's enough energy and support for the writers and for the actors, and that the highest up people, these David Zaslavs and the Bob Igers and the Ted Sarandos, you know, these guys look so out of touch every time they make public statements. I think it was Bob Iger from Disney who was like, oh, what the writers are asking for is unreasonable. And then, like, you know, a number of celebrities have tweeted that you make $77,000 a day. Like, you're being unreasonable. And so I think that they can't seem to open their mouths without revealing themselves to be very out of touch. And I think that doesn't play well with the bulk of people, even those of us who are like, oh, actors make millions and they just get to put on costumes and have fun. Yeah, but the people who pay them make 100 times what they're making. So what do you think about that? And most people, I think, generally think that that level of excess is not cool. for lack of better articulation of it. I think what we'll start to see is a number of independent filmmakers who are not part of the AMPTP, so not the major studios. There has already been a deal reached, A24, which is an independent studio. They reached a deal. They said, hey, we'll meet all the writers' requirements. We'll meet all the SAG requirements. And they will get to go back into production. And it also, my ex has, he can't make any shows, but he can contract out as an independent filmmaker. And so he can make features. So he is actually just today finalized his deal. So he'll be able to go back into production in October. So there will be these smaller houses, maybe like the Reese Witherspoons, these people who have their own studios that are not connected with Warner Brothers or Disney or Netflix or Amazon Prime. And those people can work. And once productions get up and running that are not affiliated with the AMPTP and revenue starts happening again and you're putting people back to work again, then the big guys are going to be losing out. And so then they're going to have to scramble and be like, well, crap, now we need to come to the table. And at that point, if work is already underway for a number of people, that puts the unions, that puts labor in a stronger position going ahead. And so my fingers are crossed that that's how it will happen. I will also say to the average listener, to Tracy from Wisconsin, that no one should boycott their services or going to the movies at this point. That will not, that does not support the writers, it doesn't support the actors. So if you say, oh, wow, Netflix seems like a bunch of a-holes, I'll cancel my service, that basically then says to Netflix, well, now we don't need to provide this service. I read something that compared it to, like, if everyone boycotts a restaurant, they'll close the restaurant. But if everybody comes to the restaurant and there's only one cook, you need to pay that cook, right? And so in a similar vein, anyone who wants to help, there are donation sites where you can help the artist funds. And these are not being exploited by the Fran Dreschers and the Mark Ruffalos. These are for the rank and filers who make usually under $50,000, $60,000 a year. And it's, you know, helps. There's funds to help people get groceries and funds to keep people being able to pay their rents and mortgages. If somebody wants to help, it, the boycott is not useful, but the donations.
On the point about CEOs is that they always make it so easy for the unions. It's the golden toilet phenomenon, right? Where you'll always have one CEO who just looks so out of touch with reality and humanity that it's so easy for the unions to turn around and say, well, this guy has a golden toilet. Who are you going to listen to? All right. Well, yeah, thanks for coming on and talking to me about this issue.
Thank my guests Kurt, aka KC Scott, and Courtney Bell for joining me in this episode. If you'd like to contribute to a fund that supports striking workers, I will include the links in the show notes. In the next episode, sociology will ruin something completely different.